When God seeks to communicate His will to men, He could have chosen to do it in a number of different ways. He could have simply provided us with a simple list of do's and don'ts. And even though there is some element of that in His Word, He chooses, more often than not, to do it in a very different way. Frequently, He chooses to wrap truth in human flesh, and therefore in Scripture we find a number of examples of men and women who obeyed Him, who sought to follow and love Him, and who were blessed as a result, and men and women who rejected Him, who turned their back on Him, and who lived with the tragic consequences of their decision. One of the most effective means of learning is for us to have those lessons lived out before us. And I think that's why so much of the Bible tells us of God being at work in the lives of people. For this year, of course, we're reading through the books of Samuel, and on the fourth Sunday morning, as I had mentioned as we got started with the year, on the fourth Sunday, we're going to pause and we're going to take a chapter from our reading this month and to delve into that chapter a little bit more deeply. And this morning, we're going to actually look at 1 Samuel chapter 8. But before we get to that chapter, just to sort of set the stage for what's going on here, back in chapter 6, you'll remember that the people of Israel experienced some of the darkest days in all of their history, that the Philistines had won this great victory and captured the ark, and that the ark would be in enemy hands for a period of some 7 months. And yet, because God brought such dramatic and painful plagues upon the Philistines, the ark is eventually returned to Israel, and yet even then we find that some of the Israelites, at least, are casual and careless in their handling of the ark, and the Lord strikes down a number of Israelites as a result. Though the people mourn at that point in time, it will not be for another 20 years or so until they genuinely repent of their sin. And in chapter 7, we find God bringing about this great revival as the land of their enemies are subdued. Land that had been captured by their enemies is once again restored to the nation of Israel, and there is some semblance of peace that pervades the land. But as we come to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and remember, you're in Judges, we've got to get to 1 Samuel chapter 8. But in 1 Samuel chapter 8, there are several more years of time that pass. And with the passing of those years, there begins to blow within Israel these winds of change. Samuel the prophet the youthful Samuel has given away to a much older version. The fire of enthusiasm that burned within Israel in chapter 7 has seemingly waned. And as a result, the soil is ripe for a selfish and a sinful decision for that seed to be planted, and it begins to sprout in the minds of Israel's leadership. During his years with Eli, Samuel had learned much. And in fact, had become a much stronger influence for good in the nation of Israel than even what Eli had. He possessed a much wider sphere of ministry than what Eli did. And yet, as Chad mentioned in his talk a moment ago, while Samuel learned from Eli's successes, he failed to learn from some of Eli's mistakes, and in particular, his mistakes as a parent. The similarities between Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and Samuel's two sons, Joel and Abijah, are striking. And the writer seems to put a particular point of emphasis on that element and how it plays a role in Israel coming to Samuel and requesting a king. Now, the reasons behind this request, we must actually back up a little bit into the book of Judges, because here Israel's leadership simply looks to apply some human logic. And one of the things that obviously is a factor is the internal division within the nation of Israel itself. Here in Judges chapter 17 and verse 6, Judges 17 and verse 6, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Look over at chapter 21 of the same book, verse 25, the last verse of the book. We find this very same declaration that in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. According to the history that's recorded on the pages of the book that we know as Judges, to this point in time, Israel stands simply as a loose confederation of tribes. They're not a unified people. The merging of all of those tribes into a single, well-defined nation simply hasn't happened during the days of the Judges. And the dangers connected to being such a loosely knit organization is that when an enemy attacks, you have very little chance, at least, of winning the initial battle. You also face the difficulty of internal power struggles where there is one tribe or one group of men looks to exert more influence and more authority than others. And remember that as we move into the book of 1 Samuel, that though the title of the book has changed, the period of time in Israel's history has not. And so when the elders recognize this aspect about their nation, the conclusion that they're going to arrive at is that the only way for them to actually become a unified nation is for them to have a physical king. And of course, they will sadly ignore the fact that they already were to serve an all-powerful monarch. If they had simply been willing to bow to the real king, to submit to his authority, to obey his laws, they would have experienced a far greater unity than they will ever experience under the leadership of a physical king. And yet, remember that as we move into 1 Samuel, that the theme is still the same. Every man doing what is right in his own eyes, there is no king in the land. But look over at 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 12. 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 12. Now we're skipping a little further ahead, but we're told something in this verse that provides us, again, further insight into this request for a king. Israel had suffered greatly during the days of the Judges. Neighboring nations were a constant threat to their security. On numerous occasions in the book of Judges, we read of how those adversaries oppressed various tribes. And as the book of Judges, at least in terms of the judges themselves, comes to an end, we find that this particular enemy at hand is the Philistines themselves. And the Philistines were to the west of Israel. But look at verse 12 now. 1 Samuel 12 and verse 12, when you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king. Here we find some additional information, that you already have the Philistines posing a problem on the western flank of Israel. And now we find something that we're not told in the chapter that we're about to study, and that is that at the same time, the Ammonites are to the eastern flank of Israel. And they are causing problems as well. And so Israel's meager military resources are simply going to be insufficient in their minds to deal with battles that are on two opposing fronts. And so you have division inside the kingdom. You have enemies lurking on the outside of the kingdom. And it's going to compel Israel's leadership to come to the conclusion that what they need to give them internal unity and security and external protection is a physical king. Again, what they failed to remember was that in the past, when various enemies had oppressed them, the problem was not the system of leadership that they were under. The problem always traced back to the fact that they had turned away from God in the first place. And even in the midst of the most dire of circumstances, when they genuinely turned back to God and prayed for His help, deliverance and salvation and renewed security were always supplied to them without the aid of any kind of physical king. And so as the Israelites, the elders of Israel contemplate their situation, they totally miss the reality that the key is in their approach to God and His will. They fail to understand that there will never be any kind of permanent protection from the enemies that surround them unless they are serving God with a whole heart. And so go now, if you would, to 1 Samuel chapter 8, because in spite of the fact that time and again, God has proven that He will be successful in overcoming their enemies if they will trust in Him, instead, the elders of Israel are convinced that a new way of doing things is needed to supply them with greater security. And so it's here that we find that there is this recognition that there's a decay in leadership. Beginning in chapter 8 and verse 1, it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, the name of the second Abijah. They were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." Samuel, you're getting up there in years, and just like Eli's sons weren't like their dad, your sons aren't like you. That as faithful as you have been, Samuel, Joel and Abijah are the exact opposite of who you are. They are dishonest men, and yet they serve as judges simply to line their own pockets. Now, there's differences, obviously, in the crimes that are being committed, or mentioned at least, between Eli's sons and Samuel's sons. But the reality is that their crimes, even though they're different, they reflect the same contempt for God, the same contempt for His will, and the same contempt for God's people. They are abusing their positions of power, and they're misusing their religious authority. And what is especially tragic here is that even though they were clearly unsuitable for public service of any kind, Samuel is apparently either unwilling or he was unable to see them in their true light. He's the one who actually appoints them to the role that they hold here. And so as the elders of Israel consider their future without the wise and godly Samuel, they come to legitimately fear what is going to happen if the mantle of leadership naturally passes from Samuel to Samuel's sons. Now, it spoke well of Samuel. It spoke well of his ministry that they recognized his godly walk. It's commendable that these elders are thinking about the future. And it's also commendable that they take those thoughts about the future to God's representative. Samuel is going to feel as though he's the one who's being rejected, that they don't appreciate his work on their behalf. But it's commendable that they verbalize the fact that they're moving forward and not moving backward. They're concerned about what's going to transpire when the aging Samuel dies and they see his wicked sons naturally stepping in to take the reins from Samuel because he's already appointed them as judges. And they realize that if that should happen, it will be impossible to remove them from that place of leadership. But what they are wanting is not just a change in leadership. What they're after is a fundamental change in the political structure of Israel itself. This is a rejection not just of the chosen judges, because God had already selected them. Samuel is one of them. What they are in favor of is a human lineage of leaders. And the irony here is that the very things that they feared would take place if Samuel's son should come to reign, they're going to put into place with a fixed monarchy. And they're going to magnify the very problems that they see with Samuel's sons. Manasseh, a man who is going to be perhaps the most ungodly king that Israel would ever know, will come to the throne as a result of his connection to his father, and he will exert his evil influence for 52 years. Now, as you think about the reasons why these men desire a king, all of them make good sense, don't they? Every single one of them is very logically thought through. And they're certainly justified in planning for the future. But again, they fail to see the real issue. What had created the internal division, the sense of insecurity, was their departure from the true king. The threats of external danger, the decay in leadership, is exacerbated because of their refusal to genuinely serve their God. And yet, in spite of their logical reasons behind their request, God is well aware of their true motives. And God has His own reasons for acquiescing to their request. The first one is that this is in reality a fulfillment of the Lord's plan. Turn back to the book of Genesis. Go all the way back to the days of Abraham. Genesis chapter 17. Because long before the elders ever come to Samuel with their request, God has already predicted that monarchs are going to be at least a part of the way of life within the nation of Israel. This is a statement that is made to Abram all the way back in Genesis chapter 17, notice verse 6, where God says, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings will come forth from you. Skip down to verse 16, same chapter. Genesis chapter 17, verse 16, I will bless her, that is Sarai. And indeed I will give you a son by her, then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Now fast forward to the book of Genesis chapter 49. And so not only has Abraham had a son in the form of Isaac, but Isaac has had two sons in the form of Jacob and Esau. And Jacob himself has had numerous sons. And so when you get to Genesis chapter 49, what we find is this aged Jacob by this point in time making predictions about each one of his particular sons. And I want you to notice verse 10, what he says about the tribe of Judah. He says in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. One last passage along this line. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 17. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, we find here that God nor Moses had forgot about what was said earlier. Here in Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 14 beginning, we find that God makes a prediction about or a levels instruction in regard of a king that will come as he prepares them for entering the promised land. Verse 14, Deuteronomy 17 and verse 14, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. Keep in mind that terminology. We'll hear that over in 1 Samuel chapter 8 again. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your own countrymen. You shall set as a king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he increase silver and gold for himself. And of course, if you're familiar with the monarchs of Israel, you realize how quickly the monarchy departs from that very clear instruction. What all of those passages tell us is that Israel's request for a king does not catch God off guard, that their desire for a physical monarch is not a surprise to him. And yet, at the same time, we understand from what we've already read over there in verse 5, that their request of Samuel for a king is not spawned by their understanding of these past prophecies. God's not opposed to Israel having a monarchy. He is opposed to their motivation. He is opposed to the reason why they're looking for a king. He is opposed for the kind of king that they're looking for. And their request flows not out of a trust in God, not out of their understanding of these predictions. And yet in spite of that, God is going to use it in a wonderful way to achieve his purposes. Now go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8, and let's pick up our reading now in verse 6. 1 Samuel chapter 8. And let's pick up our reading in verse 6, where we are told, but the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds of which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Yes, it's true that their request involves a rejection of the human judge, that being Samuel. But God says the real rejection here, Samuel, is not of you as a prophet, it's not of your work, it's of me, it's of my providence, it's of my protection of them. The facts that they bring to Samuel are undeniable. He is getting older. His sons are unsuitable for leadership. They're not spiritually minded successors. Clearly there is some kind of change that needs to occur as they transition from the present situation to a future one. But understand that their approach to Samuel has nothing to do with seeking God's help to find a way forward. They don't come to Samuel as a prophet and ask him, hey, can you go consult with God to determine what is going to be the best solution for us moving forward in light of this impending issue? Instead, they come to Samuel with their own predetermined solution. They've already decided what the fix is. And all they're wanting Samuel to do is not render a decision on what they've chosen, but simply to implement what they have chosen. In their minds, if they're going to survive as a nation, it will only happen if they have a recognized human leader who has military capabilities, who provides them with an international status that's similar to the nations that are around them. What Israel is wanting is what they believe the other nations already have. They want a king to guide them, as we'll see here in a moment, someone who leads them in the battle, somebody who will protect them from outside forces, someone who will preside over their council, someone who would ensure that they always have the necessities of life. And what they forgot about was the fact that they weren't supposed to be like everyone else. Their divine purpose was for them to be distinct and separate and holy and unique, people who would shine as lights in the midst of a dark world. And the reality was they already had a king that provided them the very things that they were looking for, guidance and provision and protection. But what their request reveals is their intention to abandon that king, the king that they couldn't see, in favor of a king that they would. And you'll notice in verse 8, a very interesting reference to me in verse 8, God tells Samuel that in terms of their motivation, in terms of their behavior, they really aren't all that different from the generation, the first generation that came out of Egypt and died in the wilderness. Hundreds of years have passed since that time. And what we discover here, what God declares, is that they are still looking for security in someone or something other than God. Now, he's going to acquiesce to their request. He is going to provide them a physical human monarch. And yet, he is going to use that to achieve his own purposes in bringing about the eventual king, the Messiah, the true king of all kings. But notice in verse 9, picking up, that there's a second element here, and there is this is an enactment of godly discipline to some extent. Picking up our reading in verse 9. He says, now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. He said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons, and by the way, focus on the word take here. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and to make his weapons of war and equipment of for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. God's response is intriguing, isn't it, here? Look, Samuel, go ahead and acquiesce to their request, but make sure they understand exactly what it's going to involve. Remember, their desire for a king, they believe, is going to supply them with freedom. What God wants to tell them is, look, it's going to only expose you to more tyranny and more oppression. The corruption of power was the very thing that they feared would happen with Samuel when Samuel died and his sons were allowed to take the reins. And yet now they look to solve the problem with a representative for which it will be almost impossible for them to get rid of. That by creating a monarchy, they would give to a single individual more power and more authority than Samuel or his sons ever would have possessed. And they will put that into the hands of a single man. By giving them a king, God is in essence exercising an element of discipline. Because the king is not going to make life easier for them. It's not going to make life more convenient for them. Instead, it's going to give to one man the ability and the authority to take and to take, not to give, that they will serve him and he will not serve them. And yet, as Samuel spells out the detailed consequences connected to the request, he tells them, look, when things go bad, you guys aren't going to be in a position, you're not going to be entitled to ask God for relief. And yet, in spite of that, notice how the chapter ends, picking up in verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, so that we may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Now, after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. Not only do they persist in their demands, but you'll notice that they elaborate on their selfish motivation. What they want is they want a permanent judge. They want someone who will lead them into battle. And yet, even with that decision, God does not leave them to their own devices. God, just as we saw back in Deuteronomy chapter 17, it will be someone from among their own countrymen. God is going to choose who this king is going to be. Now, what can we take away from this? Four quick truths, and then we'll wrap up our study this morning. The first one that I see in this chapter is the importance of having the right perspective. I find it interesting here that both Samuel and numerous other prophets see the monarchy as a rejection of God and his rule over them. In their minds, the king is actually going to stand between the people and God. That the king is, in a sense, going to draw the allegiance of the people away from God and focus it on himself. Micah chapter 4 and verse 9, for example. Now, why do you cry loudly? Is there no king among you? And has your counselor perished? That agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth? In other words, the prophet saying, look, you guys got the leader you said you wanted. This was going to make life so much better for you. What are you crying about? Hosea chapter 13, verses 10 and 11. Where now is your king that he may save you in all your cities and your judges of whom you requested? Give me a king and princes. I gave you a king in my anger and took him away in my wrath. But on the other hand, particularly in the book of Psalms, the monarchy is viewed in a positive way. It's seen as a divine gift to the people, that the king is going to act as God's representative, and that from that position he will lead them in their service to God. He will help them to see God's character and God's purposes and God's plan. And so Psalm 72 and verse 17, for example, speaking of the king, he says, may his name endure forever. May his name increase as long as the sun shines, and let me bless themselves by him. Let all the nations call him, that is the king, blessed. Psalm 89, verses 3 and 4. I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn to David my servant. I will establish your seed forever and build up your throne to all generations. What those passages reveal to us is that the monarchy can be seen as being good or bad. That both of those perspectives are legitimate. But it depends on what you're seeing. It depends on the direction from which you're looking at them. And so when we're talking about the monarchy, what mattered was not so much the thing itself, but their attitude toward it, their motivation for it. And the reflection of that attitude and that motivation, either for their relationship with God or because of their lack of relationship with God. A second truth that comes from this text is that we ourselves need to beware of being dissatisfied with who we are. Israel was God's chosen people. He had established a covenant with them at Mount Sinai. He had uniquely informed them by the revelation that was given to them in his law. He had led and protected them when they were in the wilderness. And during the days of the judges, it was God who raised up judges to deliver the nation of Israel. But here their very identity is in doubt. What they want is a status that's similar to their pagan neighbors. Understand that they have lived around those neighbors for now more than 300 years of time. And what they have decided is that they would much rather be like their neighbors than for their neighbors to be like them. They've grown tired of being who they are. They don't want to be unique. They don't want to stand out in the world. What they're after is the security that they think conformity and compromise will bring to them. They don't want what they were created to be. They don't want what they were chosen to be. They don't want what they were supposed to be. They're not satisfied with what God has done for them. They're not content where God has placed them. And so there is this desire on their part for a new status, a new respect and acceptance among her ungodly neighbors, grasping at something that they think is going to be better for them. And yet, if we're familiar with how the history of Israel plays out, we understand that it's going to bring a loss of the very things that they were hoping to attain. Now, how do we as modern saints, we're not governed by kings or queens, we have no experience with tribal confederations, and yet we still opt for the same path of compromise and conformity. We want to be like everybody else. We're tired of being who we are or who we are intended to be. That we become so eager to respond relevantly to our contemporary culture that we begin to accommodate ourselves to the world's ways of thinking. And if you don't believe that, just look around at churches who, you know, have adopting women in roles of leadership, changes of perspective in terms of homosexuality from people that you never would have thought would have ever acquiesced on those kinds of points. And yet here we are in 2017, and churches are doing exactly that. Folks, the world needs salt and light. And if we become like the world, then we become the ones in need of salt and light. That's not our role. Our role is to be salt, and it is to be light. And I think we are much more like the nation of Israel than we care to admit. That we look for security in the money we have, the possessions we own, the relationships we sustain, the job that we have, and in the process we become something that we were never meant to be. What God intends for us to be is God's examples in a dark world, to be light in darkness, to be God, to wear His image, and we're to project that image to those around us. But when we start looking to be like the nations around us, we've surrendered our purpose. We might as well throw in the towel and just quit and go home, because we've abandoned the one thing that we're supposed to be about, and that's being unique and different. Let's not become dissatisfied with who we're supposed to be. Third, do we realize that saying now can be as bad as saying no? Again, God had previously spoken about the monarchy, and He certainly is going to use that to bring about His own king in the form of Jesus. And therefore, clearly God is not opposed to the concept by itself. What He has a problem with is not the fact that they want a king. It's the way that they want it, and the fact that they want it now. That they're not just wrongly motivated, but they're selfishly driven. They are impatiently persistent. Samuel says, look, here's all of the price tags that's connected to it. And they say, we still want it. You've been there and I've been there, haven't you? Where someone is loving and compassionate, and they show us, look, this is where you are going. And we turn a deaf ear to it. And we go that anyway. We go that direction anyway. And God says in verse 8, this is exactly who they've been ever since they left Egypt. Understand, folks, that's some 400 years earlier. God says, look, you guys are the same people that you were when you came out of Egypt. And Ezekiel, when they're being carried away into captivity, is going to make exactly the same point. You people haven't changed. You want what you want, and you want it now, instead of going with God's timing. And so we need to learn that waiting for God and to experience His best is always better than settling for something that is inferior and settling for it because of our own impatience. James 1 and verse 4, let endurance or patience have its perfect result so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And then fourth and finally, how often do we look to take the easy way out? Israel had suffered greatly in the days of the judges. Numerous neighboring nations had posed a continual threat to them. But the source of their anguish was not the political structure within the nation of Israel. The problem was always their apostasy. And when you study the book of Judges and you study the first seven chapters of the book of Samuel, what you find is that God's divinely delegated deliverer, a lot of D's there, who God had provided to be the means of rescuing Israel from her enemies, had always proven to be a sufficient and adequate to meet their needs. And that said, it was a system that demanded courage, and it was a system that demanded faith. It's difficult to trust in God, isn't it? When you are all by yourselves, you're splintered in different tribes, and there is an enemy that is threatening you at your border. If you're going to feel secure, it's a lot easier, isn't it, to have a standing army in place and a visible monarch who you know will lead that army into battle. It takes a lot of faith to trust in a system that is willing to live without any visible forms of defense until the need arises. And demanding a king is not only the taking the easy way out, but it blames the political system instead of the real problem, and that was their own unfaithfulness. What about us this morning? Because we were not only created with an ability to choose, but we were also given the responsibility to make good choices. And yet God doesn't force us to make the right ones. And God doesn't overrule our bad ones, even when they're contrary to His will and detrimental to our own well-being. There are times when God treats us just like He taught Israel. If that's what you want to have, here's what I'm going to give you. You can have it. And then you'll find out that, you know what, it's not what you thought it was going to be. But God lets us make our own choices, even if we choose the easy way out, the path of least resistance. But what we find in the chapters that follow in 1 Samuel is that He'll give us our choice, but He's not going to overrule the unfortunate consequences that are attached to those choices. This morning as we close, who have you chosen to serve? Who have you decided to obey and to follow? Who will you give your allegiance to? Where will you find your security? In the stuff that you have? In government programs? Or will you find your security in Him? This morning we invite you to give your allegiance to the true King, Jesus Christ, who rules over an eternal kingdom. And you and I, we can be a part of that kingdom and experience all of the blessings that are connected to that.